West Lafayette Public Library Director Nick Schinkel reviews the book No Graves As Yet, a novel of World War I by bestselling author Ann Perry. Schinkel begins by reading from the book.
It was a golden afternoon in late June, a perfect day for cricket. The sun burned in a cloudless sky, and the breeze was barely sufficient to stir the slender, pale skirts of the women as they stood on the grass at Fenner's Field, parasols in hand. The men in white flannels were relaxed and smiling. St. John's were batting, and Gonville and Gaius were fielding. The bowler pounded up to the crease and sent the ball down fast, but a bit short and wide. Elwin Allard leaned forward and, with an elegant cover drive, dispatched the ball to the boundary for 4 runs. Joseph Reevely joined in the applause. Elwin was one of his students, rather more graceful with the bat than with the pen. He had little of the scholastic brilliance of his brother Sebastian, but he had a manner that was easy to like and a sense of honor that drove him like a spur. St. John still had 4 more batsmen to play, young men from all over England who had come to Cambridge and, for one reason or another, remained at college through the long summer vacation. Elwin hit a modest 2. The heat was stirred by a faint breath of wind from across the fenlands and with their dikes and marshes flat under the vast skies stretching eastward to the sea. It was old land, quiet, cut by secret waterways, Saxon churches marking each village. It had been the last stronghold of resistance against the Norman invasion 8.5 centuries ago. On the field, one of the boys just missed a catch. There was a gasp and then a letting out of breath. All this mattered. Such things could win or lose a match, and they would be playing against Oxford again soon. To be beaten would be catastrophic. Across the town behind them, the clock on the North Tower at Trinity struck 3, each chime on the large A-flat bell. Then followed the instant after on the smaller E-flat. Joseph thought how out of place it seemed to think of time on an eternal afternoon like this. A few feet away, Harry Beecher caught his eye and smiled. Beecher had been a Trinity man in his own years as a student. It was a long-standing joke that the Trinity clock struck once for itself and once for St. John's. A cheer went up as the ball hit the stumps, and Elwin was bowled out with a very respectable score of 83. He walked off with a little wave of acknowledgement and was replaced at the crease by Lucian Forbister, who was a little too bony, but Joseph knew his awkwardness was deceiving. He was more tenacious than many of them gave him credit for, and he had flashes of extraordinary grace. Play resumed with the sharp crack of a strike and the momentary cheers under the burning blue of the sky. Well, so opens Ann Perry's novel, No Graves As Yet. Many Americans and Britishers and Canadians are entranced by the turn of the last century, the early 1900s. Just watch TV almost any evening on the PBS television network. And so I've chosen No Graves As Yet to plunge us into that long ago world, a world that opens with a cricket match in the summer of 1914, yes, 100 years ago. It was the year that would soon see the outbreak of the greatest war the world had known, the war that was declared to be the war to end all wars. And it was to be a cakewalk for the Allies, or for the Axis, declare your side. But in this early summer of 1914, amidst the rolling hills and the riverine landscape of the ancient Cambridge University, the First World War was a yet-to-be tragedy, as our likable enough protagonist, the Reverend Joseph Reevely, learns the death of his parents on that sunny afternoon filled with the sights and the sounds of the local week's cricket match. To continue our introduction, we read. The far end of the pitch, Forbister struck an awkward shot, elbows in all the wrong places, and sent the ball right to the boundary. There was a shout of approval, and everyone clapped. Joseph was aware of a movement somewhere behind him and half-turned, expecting a grounds official, perhaps to say it was time for lemonade and cucumber sandwiches. But it was his own brother, Matthew, who was walking toward him, his shoulders tight, no grace in his movement. He was wearing a light gray city suit, as if he had newly arrived from London. Joseph started to cross the green, anxiety rising quickly. Why was his brother here in Cambridge interrupting a match on a Sunday afternoon? Matthew, what is it? He said as he reached him. Matthew stopped. His face was so pale it seemed almost bloodless. He was 28. 7 years the younger, broader-shouldered, and fair where Joseph was dark. He was steadying himself with difficulty, and he gulped before he found his voice. It's... He cleared his throat. There was a kind of desperation in his eyes. It's mother and father, he said hoarsely. There's been an accident. Joseph refused to grasp what he had said. An accident? Matthew nodded, struggling to govern his ragged breathing. In the car, they are both dead. For a moment, the words had no meaning for Joseph. Instantly, his father's face came to mind, lean and gentle, blue eyes steady. It was impossible that he could be dead. The car went off the road, Matthew was saying, just before the Hoxton Mill Bridge. His voice sounded strange and far away. Behind Joseph, they were still playing cricket. He heard the sound of the ball and another burst of applause. Joseph! Matthew's hand was on his arm, the grip tight. Joseph nodded and tried to speak, but his throat was dry. I'm sorry, Matthew said quietly. I wish I hadn't had to tell you like this. It's all right, Matthew. He changed his mind, still trying to grasp the reality. The Hoxton Road? Where were they going? Matthew's fingers tightened on his arm. They began to walk slowly, close together, over the sun-baked grass. There was a curious dizziness in the heat. The sweat trickled down Joseph's skin, and inside he was cold. Matthew stopped again. Father telephoned me late yesterday evening, he said huskily, as if the words were almost unbearable for him. He said someone had given him a document outlining a conspiracy so hideous it would change the world we know and would ruin England and everything we stand for. Forever. He sounded defiant now, the muscles of his neck and jaw clenched as if he barely had mastery of himself. Joseph's mind whirled. What should he do? The words hardly made sense. John Reevely had been a member of Parliament until 1912, 2 years ago. He'd resigned for reasons he had not discussed. But he had never lost his interest in political affairs, nor his care for honesty in government. Perhaps he had simply been ready to spend more time reading, indulging his love of philosophy, poking around in antique and secondhand bookshops, looking for a bargain. More often he was just talking with people, listening to stories, swapping eccentric jokes, and adding to his collection of limericks. A conspiracy to ruin England and everything we stand for? Joseph repeated incredulously. No. Matthew corrected him with precision. A conspiracy that would ruin it. That was not the main purpose, simply a side effect. What conspiracy? By whom? Joseph demanded. Matthew's skin was so white it was almost gray. I don't know. He was bringing it to me. Today. Joseph's parents' death breaks the cloistered world that was the lot of students and faculty at Cambridge University that lazy summer. Two deaths that early on point to the good reverend and his spymaster brother to puzzle over what was the secret horror that his parents died with. Died before they could share the secret with anyone. That is the key question of this slow-moving but ever-so-interesting mystery set in England that long-ago summer in the world of academe. It is, as we said, 1914. The old world of Europe was fat and it was happy. Colonies spread across the world brought both excitement and exotic produce. The political and social structure that had been built up around the Eurocentric world seemed indestructible, though on the edges there were hints of trouble brewing. The festering independence movement in Ireland and the machinations of the Serbian upstart nationalists in Central Europe. Those were enough rumblings to cause men and women of conscience and sensitivity to fear for the peace their families had known for generations. And it was rumbling that soon roars to the surface of the usually placid Cambridge campus that summer term, as first that older couple out for a Sunday drive are killed in a bizarre auto crash, and all too soon after, a Golden Boy student is found murdered in his dorm room. The deaths, dare we say murders, don't stop there. Death sweeps through the campus yet again, taking a beloved professor and close friend of Joseph Weevely into its horrific maw. But we get ahead of ourselves. No sooner do the good reverend and his spymaster brother begin to deal with the sudden death of their parents than another tragedy hits. The golden student we mentioned earlier, Sebastian Allard by name, is found dead in the early morning hours not many days later. Sebastian's death was discovered with no sign of forced entry, and the young man was seemingly caught by death in the midst of his quiet morning study, tea at hand, an open book on his lap. The seemingly pointless death of the young student in particular rips open the staid English veneer of calm which floats on that ancient college, and of course we readers are pulled into the slow whirlpool of deceit and duplicity, as we all soon discover that no one is really who we think they are or have come to know, and everyone has a backstory, sometimes uplifting, sometimes not so much. It is now that the characters of No Graves as Yet come into play. And while some are haphazardly drawn, some are clearly, even movingly, imagined. One can argue the murder mysteries that pulse at the center of this novel are not the real reasons to read it. Joseph's parents, the older couple who die in the odd, one might say mysterious, auto accident that afternoon, are sketchily drawn at the opening of the novel. And as they are soon killed in the father's pursuit of a diplomatic one-man mission, we get to discover them slowly as the novel develops. Open-minded and kind to the point of naivete, the elder Reevely had evidently discovered a document that threatens to blow the established world order to smithereens and is killed by persons unknown because of it. College student Sebastian Allard is introduced to us early on that same day of the parents' death as the golden boy of his small town and now of Cambridge College. Handsome, razor-sharp smart, and endowed with a personality that allows him a welcome berth in any social circle he chooses to join, Sebastian is also incredibly conflicted by his love for English heritage that envelops him at Cambridge and the horrors of war that may be necessary so that his beloved England can endure. These are twin emotions that Joseph tussles with as well. And as Sebastian's mentor and sometime professor, both are early on drawn into the swirl of events that are to overwhelm both of them that fateful summer 100 years ago. That same fate-filled, if beautiful, June day, we meet Joseph's erstwhile brother, whose career so pained their father. It seems that Matthew was the last hope for a physician in the family. Matthew Reevely is a study in British reserve and family rectitude. His career in the shadow world of intelligence, some would call it spying, becomes critical to discovering the meaning behind the murders that strike at men and women, both on and off campus, and to Anne Perry's spinning of the mystery, even as Matthew falls in and out of the main plot line. As our story develops further, we come to meet the stolid, but not too imaginative, Inspector Perth, who throws the young men of the college and their adult mentors into a slow boiling tizzy as he insists that no one is above suspicion for the murders on campus, no matter their background or their social standing, thus spitting in the eye of this ripened world of 1914 with its clear social boundaries and expectations that were still firmly entrenched. Here's Perth talking with Joseph, the professor, about just this topic. "Well, I never knew that." Perth clearly found it beyond his comprehension. "You don't understand," Joseph went on. "At university, there are always those who are more brilliant than you are, more spectacularly gifted in a particular area. If you didn't know that when you came, you would certainly learn it very quickly. Every student here has sufficient talent and intellect to succeed if he works. I know of no one foolish enough to carry anything more than a passing amount of envy for a superior mind." He said it with absolute certainty, and was only when he looked at Perth's expression that he realized how condescending he sounded, but it was too late to retrieve it. "So you didn't notice anything at all?" Perth observed. It was impossible to tell if he believed that or what he thought of a teacher and minister who could be so blind. Joseph felt like a new student chastised for a stupid mistake. "Nothing I thought could lead to more than a passing stiffness, a distance," he defended himself. "Young men are emotional, highly strung sometimes. Exams," He trailed off, not knowing what else to add. He was trying to explain a culture and a way of life to a man for whom it was totally foreign. The gulf between a Cambridge student and a policeman was unbridgeable. How could Perth possibly understand the passions and dreams that impelled young men from backgrounds of privilege and, in most cases, a degree of wealth? Men whose academic gifts were great enough to earn them places here. He must come from an ordinary home where learning was a luxury. Money, never quite enough. Necessity, a constant companion on the heels of labor. A cold breath touched him. Fear that Perth would inevitably come to wrong conclusions about these young men, misunderstand what they said and did, mistake motives, and blame innocence simply because it was all alien to him, and the damage would be irretrievable. Well, rounding out our main cast of characters, we get to know, to our dismay in many ways, Mary Allard, the stalwart mother of the murdered student Sebastian. Her utter and overwhelming grief causes her to lash out at everyone who does not share her unfailing worship of her golden boy son, even to the point of lashing out at Joseph, whose enchantment with Sebastian is very, very slow to crumble, even as the evidence mounts that Sebastian was perhaps not the perfect human being that he strove to present himself to everyone to be. Perry populates our story with other socially driven characters as well, not the least Joseph's stay-at-home sister, an outspoken stand-in for the suffragettes of the day, and Sebastian's secret barkeep lover, whose pacifist beliefs provides Perry with a useful foil for examining both Sebastian and Joseph's moral dilemma as they discuss and agonize over the impending European war. In the end, I was disappointed that all of Anne Perry's characters rally to the cause of the British and the Allies as World War I breaks out in our story. The mystery is wrapped up in a surprising and not expected way, and World War I is just about to descend upon the quiet Cambridge countryside. The memory of the fiercely pacifist wonder boy and student Sebastian notwithstanding. Perhaps some of her characters will have second thoughts once the war to be over by Christmas dragged on and on and on for year after year until, of course, the Yanks throw themselves into the battle in 1917. Here's how she concludes the novel. By the way, we won't tell you how the mystery was solved. We'll just wrap up the stories of these marvelously wrought characters. Joseph and Matthew sat quietly together, remembering while the light lasted, all the moments they had shared, past laughter, the happier times woven into the fabric of memory to shine in the darkness ahead. Later, Matthew's boss telephoned again. Matthew answered it and listened. "Yes," he said at length. "Yes, sir, of course. I'll be there first thing in the morning." He hung up and turned to Joseph and their sister, Judith. "Germany has declared war on France. It is massed to invade Belgium. When it happens, we will send Germany an ultimatum, which, of course, they will refuse. By midnight tomorrow, we shall be at war." Gray said, "The lamps are going out all over Europe. We shall not see them lit again in our lifetime." "Perhaps not," said Joseph, taking a deep breath. "We shall have to carry our own light, the best we can." Judith buried her head in his shoulder, and Matthew reached out around her to take Joseph's hand and grip it. In this 100th anniversary year of World War I, the great war to end all wars, I think this is a marvelous and touching way to learn something about the England and the Europe that was back then, the England and the Europe that marched so happily into that precipitously disastrous war. Anne Perry's No Graves As Yet, subtitled A Novel of World War I. It's a marvelous read for the mystery, for the characters, and for the times it tells us about. It's available at all of our fine local libraries, including, of course, the West Lafayette Public Library.
That was West Lafayette Public Library Director Nick Schinkel. He's reviewed No Graves As Yet, A Novel of World War I by Anne Perry. You can find more book reviews by Nick Schinkel on our website at wbaa.org.